Hello, everyone. I'm Dan Armendariz, preceptor in computer science for CS, and today I'm going to be talking to you about digital photography. Now, in particular, we're going to do a crash course in just 60 minutes on a number of topics in digital photography. Unfortunately, we have a packed house here to sort of like choose your own adventure, and we will we'll try to get through as much as possible. So, without further delay, unless you happen to be hiding under a rock, humanity has, for the very first time, put a lander on a comet, which is a pretty cool thing. Philae, or some way of actually pronouncing this. I've heard it pronounced in a variety of ways, but of course, this lander and the associated satellite that actually brought the lander to the comet each have some digital cameras attached and associated with them. So this is the view of Philae from Rosetta's OSIRIS narrow angle camera. So Rosetta is the machine that actually brought Philae over to the comet. Philae is the lander itself. And as Philae was on its way landing on the comet, it snapped some photos. And so there's something interesting about this that I want to point out. And first of all, this is just the lander, of course. But if you notice surrounding that, there seems to be no stars. So I added a little bit extra black just for the design of the slide. But the very center, the very corner of this slide is, in fact, the original image that came from Rosetta's OSIRIS camera. So just sort of give that some consideration. Why, if this is in fact in deep space, is it the case that there are no stars in this photograph? So just a couple of other things to take a look at. This was a photo that came back from Philae about, this was yesterday, I think, after it had actually landed. And unfortunately, it was the case where the very first time that Philae landed, it bounced a couple of times, and so it's not actually in the proper position that they expected. But still, it has this kind of neat look of the comet itself. And one of the things that's really neat about this is that you realize that Rosetta has been traveling for about 10 years through space. So this means that the digital camera technology that's contained within Philae and Rosetta is at least 10 years old. But if you go back through the records, there's actually a scientific paper that was published back in 1998 that talked about the specifics of the specifications of the cameras on each of these satellites. And this is 1998. That's a long time ago. Do you have any idea what kind of digital camera technology was available back then? There happened to be a camera, a digital camera called the Canon EOS D2000, and it was really the first digital camera that came out that people considered to be a serious and usable digital camera. So was it the case that back in 1998, when they were creating these specifications, that they simply duct taped one of these Canon EOS D2000s to this lander? Well, of course not. I mean, this is meant to be a scientific instrument, and so there's a lot of detail that actually went into this. But just to give you some context, this top-of-the-line D2000 camera had 2-megapixel sensor and could take photos at about 3.5 frames per second. So 2 megapixels is pretty abysmal. If you have a modern smartphone, such as an iPhone or an Android phone, it might be that the camera on the front of your device actually has 1 or 2 megapixels, about the same number of pixels as the Rosetta camera itself. That's sort of the high-quality one. The Philae lander actually has other cameras that are only 1 megapixel each. I think there's an array of 6 for panoramas, and then there's another for some scientific studies. And so basically the photo that we were just looking at was taken essentially with a 1-megapixel camera. Now, of course, this is kind of not a very fair comparison, because when we're talking about the scientific aspect of digital photography, then there's a lot of additional work that has to go into making sure that it's actually going to be correct and that they can actually get some usable data out of this. And there's some interesting things about the Rosetta camera that we can actually learn from the paper that was published back in 98. In particular, it had a 4-megapixel camera, which was pretty impressive. It actually had a very large sensor size. We'll talk more about sensor size. That was pretty well equivalent to a standard 35-millimeter frame. We'll talk more about that in just a little bit, hopefully if we actually get to it. And the maximum shutter speed, so in other words, the maximum amount of time the fastest amount of time that this sensor was actually able to capture data and to capture the lights for the exposure was 1/100th of a second, which is frankly pretty abysmal compared to this digital camera that came out in 1998, which operated at about 1/4000th or maybe even 1/8000th of a second. So let's take a look at another image from space. This came out of JAXA, which is Japan's space agency, and this is a picture of their released a satellite that went around the moon and took some photographs, and this was, I believe, a moonrise that came over that. And it's a fantastic image, but again, you have to wonder, what is going on? Why are there no stars in this scene? So realize that when we're talking about digital photography, one of the most important aspects of it is to consider the exposure. And of course, exposure is not something that we actually deal with solely in digital photography. This applies to film photography as well, and also videography and a variety of other fields where we're actually capturing images. But there's really four major things that impact the exposure. One of the most important things is the amount of available light. Now, sometimes you can control this. If you're in a studio, for example, or in this room, we could control the amount of light by turning some lights on, turning some lights off. But in the case of these satellites, they really don't have any control over this. It is the amount of sunlight that exists in the sky, or rather in space, that reflects off of each of these objects and can be collected by the sensor. So the amount of available light we may or may not have control over, depending on the circumstance. But notice that we also have three other settings as well: shutter speed, ISO, and aperture, through which any camera actually uses to manipulate to try to capture the amount of available light that exists in the environment. So another way to think about this is that you have a sensor and a digital camera. It can collect a certain amount of light. There's a range of amount of light that it can actually collect. Too little light, and it won't register, so it'll look totally dark. Too much light, and it will actually overwhelm the sensor, and it will look totally white. So we have these settings to try to compensate for the amount of available light that exists in the scene and fit that amount of light in the scene to the range that our sensor can actually capture. So let's take a step back and talk a little bit about light. So as you might recall from high school physics, light is, of course, it is photons that has properties of both wave and matter. And because of its wave, because of its properties of a wave, it operates in various wavelengths, and we as humans can only interpret and understand and receive through our eyes a small spectrum of the electromagnetic spectrum, which represents the color that we're able to see. Now, it's interesting to note, of course, that our visual system is a rather complex system that is made up of a wide variety of parts, not only just our eyes, but even all of the subparts within the eyes, including the lens, the iris, and the retina in the very back with all of the cells associated with that, but also the pathway to the brain and the visual cortex itself. And this can lead to some very interesting phenomena that actually impact us as photographers and perhaps more correctly impact the design of cameras and digital cameras. So this you may or may not have seen if you've been trolling around on the internet for long enough. It's just an optical illusion where there are two tiles that are labeled, tile A at the top of this illusion and tile B at the center, and it just so happens that they are in fact exactly the same color. So even if you know this fact, you look at it, it still doesn't look quite right. This is, in fact, a very strong visual perception that our brain is playing on us. So here I have just to try to prove this to you a little bit, I'm going to bring up the same image in Photoshop, and I'm going to bring up the eyedropper tool, select the color in the A tile, and I'm going to draw a little color bridge between A and B, and hopefully now you can sort of see what is going on, or you can at least convince yourself that this color is in fact the same in these two tiles. So let me digress a little bit, because I really am showing you this just to make clear the fact that we have a visual system that complicates matters. Our eyes do not operate scientifically like the lander, like the Philae lander would, and like a digital camera would, and this causes some problems that actually impact us as digital photographers. So if we take a look at the structure of the eye, we don't have to really worry about too much of it, but there is, of course, the iris and the lens that actually focuses the light into the back of the eye, which has the retina. The retina has a variety of cells, and in the very center of our vision, there exists a structure called the fovea, where we have a very high concentration of detail cells that allow us to see color vision and a variety of other things. Now, the retina is made up of a variety of types of cells. There's two major types that we're really concerned with. There's rods and cones. And each of these have different properties. So the rods, for example, are primarily associated with night vision, whereas cones give us our day vision. What this means is that rod cells are more sensitive to light. They're the ones that are activated and that are in use when you're outside in the middle of the night, for example. And cones tend to be in use when you have high detail vision or when you're actually in daylight. So just like we were saying, rods have more light sensitivity, cones have less. In the fovea, which was that structure that I mentioned that's in the very middle of the retina in the center of your field of view, you have a high concentration of cones and a low concentration of rods. In fact, the relative presence of rods overall in your entire retina is very high. You have far more rods than you have cones, which is pretty interesting and sort of alludes a little bit to the fact that the greatest amount of detail that we have and the greatest amount of day vision that we have is in the very center of our vision. When we go outside at night, if you've been to a planetarium, for example, you might have heard the host actually say that when you want to look at something out in the sky, actually look at it out of the corner of your eye. The reason for that is you have more rods in your periphery than you do in the center, and this means that you can perhaps see that detail a little bit better with that more sensitive cell. Now, the primary stimulus for cones is trichromatic. That means that the cones are really the ones that provide to us our color vision. So among other reasons, this in combination is why in broad daylight, we can actually perceive far more colors than we can in the middle of the night. You might have noticed that if you go outside in the middle of the night, colors don't seem to be as bright. One of the reasons for that is that the cones are the ones that provide to us our color vision, and the cones are what become inactive at night. Now, similarly, rods actually detect motion, and this is another reason why it's very useful in the periphery and why we can detect motion more in the periphery than when we're actually looking directly at something. Now, the reason that we are able to actually have trichromatic vision out of these cone cells is because we have different types of cones that respond to different wavelengths of light. And it's not an exact science. We don't say that one specific type of cone cell responds precisely to some specific wavelength of light. No, there's like a response curve that's associated with these, and that implies that some of them, there's some overlap in some, and so we might actually have sort of a non-linear stimulus to various types of colors. And in fact, this is precisely what happens. If we take a look at this, we have three different types of cells. The S-type cell, which is for short wavelengths, the M and the L types, which are absolutely the most prevalent types of cones within our eye. And you notice that those are very high up in this spectrum, much closer to the green spectrum. And this actually is very, very important to us as digital photographers and in the construction of digital cameras, because this is one of the primary reasons why, there's a lot of things that this impacts, and hopefully we'll get a chance to get to them. But the result of this is that we actually respond better to green wavelengths than we do to red or to blue. And in fact, our response curve is very different for that. And if you sort of close your eyes for just a minute and imagine that you have three similar rooms that are all totally dark, except in the very center there is a light bulb. And in one room you have a green light bulb, in one room you have a red light bulb, in another you have a blue light bulb, and that's all you have in this room for illumination. And if you imagine the relative brightness of these rooms based purely on this single light source, try to imagine which one might feel brighter. And the correct answer is green. Generally, what happens is that because our cone cells are stimulated much more by the green wavelengths than by any others, we respond much more to to that light. And so that is actually very important for our perception of brightness and luminance as opposed to some of these other colors. Now, if we take a look again at this, the eye structure that we had, of course, light that comes in on the left side of this diagram through the iris, focused by the lens, and onto this so-called sensor, our retina, at the very back of the eye. And this is very similar to the structure of a digital camera as well, in some ways. We have a lens which is actually used to focus the light, and that light is then focused onto the very back of the camera, which has the sensor. Now, this is a diagram of a digital SLR, a single lens reflex camera, which, for those of you that are unfamiliar, are sort of the more professional looking ones. They're the ones that allow you to change lenses. They're the ones that have like a hump on the top of the camera where the prism is and the viewfinder is, so you can actually look through it. The reason that it works the way that it does is that the pentaprism actually reflects the light that has come in through the lens and reflected off a mirror that operates, that sits at a 45-degree angle, goes up through the pentaprism, and then out through the viewfinder where you are able to see the image. When you actually take the exposure, the mirror moves up and out of the way, the shutter is opened, and that allows the light to pass all the way back through and directly hit the sensor, which causes the exposure to happen. So in the typical configuration, you cannot actually see the image through the viewfinder in a proper digital SLR. You cannot actually see the image through the viewfinder and also capture the image. If you happen to have one of these cameras, you might say, well, I have like a preview mode. But that, what that essentially does is it lifts the mirror out of the way. It turns off. It essentially disables the viewfinder, the optical viewfinder, and it uses the screen on the back of the camera based on the light that the sensor is receiving. Now, there's an important aspect of light to recognize beyond the fact that it is made up of wavelengths, so that it is made up of colors that as a result of the various wavelengths. And that is that the individual photons that make up the light have a direct correlation to the relative brightness or to the intensity of that light. So every time that we double the number of photons at any particular wavelength of that light, then we are essentially doubling the intensity. We're doubling the brightness of that light. And this has a very important name in photography. It's called stops. So when we're talking about exposure, we talk about stops in this way. We generally want to try to manipulate that this quantized notion of photons that are actually entering into our camera by either having or doubling the amount of light that is allowed in. So it's very, very frequent that you will see numbers related to this idea of stops. So for example, the idea of exposure compensation, which we'll talk more about in just a minute, operates in this notion of stops, where a single stop is a doubling or a halving, depending on the direction you're going, of the amount of light that's being entered. Now, of course, when we're talking about a number of stops, so for example, let's say we're talking about a change of two stops as opposed to one stop, this means we're not just doubling it, but we're doubling it again. So a change in two stops results in a 4 times difference in the intensity of the light. Likewise, a 3-stop difference is 8, 4 stops is 16, so on and so forth. So even a low number of stops can represent a wide variety of different intensities in light. And in fact, when we're talking about daylight versus the sort of the brightest day versus the darkest night, we're really talking about like 20 stops, perhaps at the absolute most. It's probably something closer to 15 stops or so. But that'll be important in just a minute as we keep talking about exposure. So we talked a little bit about light, and so let's talk about some of these other exposure settings that actually allow us to capture the light that exists in a scene. There's shutter speed, there's ISO, and aperture. And we alluded a little bit to shutter speed before, but I do have a video that sort of shows the anatomy of a camera and also will illuminate this idea of the shutter itself. So I have here this high-speed photo, which I happen to find on the internet. And what you will see is this action of actually capturing an exposure on this particular digital SLR. So as I'm talking, I want you to pay attention to a couple of things. First, notice that the mirror moves up out of the way. Recall that we talked about this in a digital SLR. Now notice that the thing that we're seeing it behind that is not the raw sensor itself, but it is in fact a piece of plastic or Kevlar, depending on the quality of the camera, that operates as the shutter. It's a mechanical shutter that actually moves out of the way and exposes the sensor underneath. So let's take a look at this one more time so you can sort of watch the action of the shutter. The mirror moves up out of the way. Notice the shutter opens, and then very quickly is there another curtain that closes behind it. This is a very typical setup for digital SLRs with mechanical shutters. We will have two curtains that operate either horizontally or vertically depending on the particular camera, and it will move across the entire plane. First, the first curtain will open, exposing the sensor underneath, and then the second curtain will close, thereby stopping the exposure. Now, there are other types of shutters as well, and really for our purposes, we don't have to worry about them too much, except for the electronic shutter. So this is a mechanical shutter, and you'll typically find this on a digital SLR. And the whole combination of these movements, including the mirror moving up out of the way, the shutter opening, and then the second curtain closing behind it, results in that characteristic click that we hear in cameras. But for cameras that don't actually make that physical noise, such as camera phones and compact cameras and smartphones and a variety of others, is that they have an electronic shutter. And the electronic shutter doesn't operate in the same way, but rather it starts to read data off the sensor and then immediately stops. Or rather, it allows the sensor to accumulate the data of the caused by or the changes in the voltage caused by photons hitting the sensor, and then it will actually clear it once the exposure is actually complete. So this is sort of the most rigid definition of of shutter speed. But what ultimately this means is that this is defining how much light we are actually receiving on the sensor plane. And ultimately, this means that we can change the shutter speed in terms of stops. We might have the shutter open for a single second, for example. And so we would say that our shutter speed is then 1 second. And what that means in the mechanical terms is that the first curtain opens, the sensor is then exposed to light for 1 second, and then the second curtain closes behind it. Then, of course, we can change this by a stop. If we go a stop brighter, this means that we then have to keep the shutter open for longer so that we can collect more photons. So a stop brighter would result in 2 second shutter speed. Likewise, a stop darker, which would mean that we have to have the shutter open for less amount of time, so we would have half a second of a shutter speed. And we can keep going in either direction, but if you play around with the settings on your camera, you probably will notice that it seems to approximately double or halve, depending on the direction of your tuning. Now, the shutter speed, because we can have it open for some arbitrary amount of time, does have some impact on our image. In particular, imagine what happens if you're capturing all of the photons in a particular scene over a couple of seconds. You might imagine that if there's some movement within this scene. So for example, there's a ball that moves across the scene. Or there, in the case of this photograph, there's a wave that moves across the scene. I'm capturing the photons from that entire movement. So this is causing a motion blur that becomes very visible within the photograph. And sometimes this is intentional. Sometimes you actually want to get some motion blur so you can smooth out the motion of the waves, for example. Or perhaps you want to actually capture movement of a fast-moving car. You want to actually capture the movement of fireworks, for example. By the way, many people love to go outside, take pictures of fireworks, and have very high, fast shutter speeds, which just looks abysmal because it's just, you know, the brief moment of explosion or a couple of seconds after, and then they're all chimping. Do you know what chimping is? It's like you take a picture, right? And then you're like hunched over your camera and you show your friends. You're like, ooh, 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 chimping, right? Okay, so coming back. So you have this idea of fireworks where it's really the movement of these fireworks that's really interesting. So try experimenting with your shutter speed and capturing the movement using a very long shutter speed rather than a very short one. Of course, this means that you can get motion blur due to a wide variety of factors. It might not just be the object in the scene that's moving quickly, as is the case in the fireworks here, or the other car or the environment in this photo on the left. But instead, imagine if you're trying to hold the phone or your camera for that long. No matter how much you actually brace yourself, you will have a small amount of movement that translates to some motion blur within your camera. So if you're trying to counteract that, you either have to increase the shutter speed so that it decreases the amount of time that the shutter is actually open and thereby freezing that motion, or you need to stabilize the camera in some way, in which case you might want to use a tripod or to set the camera down on some stable table or something along those lines to actually freeze that particular motion. So this is an artistic question that you have to ask yourself, is in which direction do I actually want to take this? Do I want to try to capture the motion by having this intentional motion blur, or do I want to freeze the motion? And sometimes freezing the motion is precisely what you want. In the example of sports photography, for example, you really want to capture that precise moment that something is happening. Or perhaps rather than get the smooth motion of the entirety of some waves, you really want to capture the sort of instant moment that a wave crashes or breaks against the rock, and you want to capture that moment. You certainly will want to capture this. By the way, this is what it looks like. My camera got soaked. I got soaked. It was totally fine. Don't worry about it. A lot of cameras are a lot stronger than you would imagine, and can sort of the buttons on the camera were a little gritty from the sand and stuff. Ended up being fine. Now, sometimes you actually want to mix both motion and still in one camera. So imagine what happens if you have a moving object and you pan your camera with that object, keeping some part of that object still, totally still, relative to some portion on your sensor. If you're able to have a long shutter speed that actually captures movement of the environment, but you keep that one part of the object still relative to some portion on your sensor, you can mix both and get a sort of neat effect where you're able to get something in sharp focus or without any motion blur, but sort of blur everything else in the environment. And sometimes this is actually what you want also for sports. Sometimes you do want to convey this motion of the motion itself, or the idea of speed. So for example, in a car race, you might not want to totally freeze the motion of the car and the wheels, because then it will look like it's not going anywhere. It's just standing on the track. Providing some of that can actually give some amount of drama to the scene. So let's take a step back from shutter speed a little bit and talk about some of these other settings as well. One of them is ISO. And you might have heard of the term in the context of sensitivity, but that's not really an accurate way of thinking about it, at least in terms of digital cameras. We're not actually changing the sensitivity of the camera. There's actually some other electronic trickery that's happening underneath the hood. But for our purposes for now, thinking of it as sensitivity is an okay way to think about it, especially in terms of exposure value. So ISO starts generally at around a value of 100. It's just sort of an arbitrary value. And it, if we are to think of it in our simplified terms as sensitivity, increasing the ISO means that the sensor becomes slightly more sensitive to light, which would then allow us to change the shutter speed to be faster. So in other words, because we're trying to get the amount of light in our scene to match the specific range of our camera, we have to play with these settings. So these two settings that we've mentioned, and also aperture that we'll talk about in just a moment, in order to really get that precise range of photons within our sensor. So one of the ways that we're able to do this, and one of the ways that we're able to alter our shutter speed, is to also change the ISO for a given scene. So by increasing the ISO, we increase the so-called sensitivity, which allows us to make the shutter speed faster. Or likewise, perhaps we actually want to make the shutter speed longer. Perhaps we actually want to have a lower ISO and increase the time that the shutter is open to capture our motion, or to capture that motion blur for some artistic purpose. Now, the downside to ISO, of course, is that we actually get a fair amount of noise as a result. And these are some examples from relatively old cameras. But generally, this shows an interesting trend, an interesting general trend, that larger cameras tend to do slightly better in combating issues of noise. And it's not really the case that larger cameras are doing it. There's a lot of factors that play into this. The age of the camera is, the age of the sensor is one important distinction, but also the size of the pixels. So it's not really the size of the camera, but the size of the pixels itself can make a huge difference, because larger pixels can capture more light. There's more area through which it can actually capture more photons. And also the electronics are a little bit bigger and can actually capture more. They can sort of hold more voltage, perhaps, and be able to give us a better signal-to-noise ratio. So there's a variety of reasons why, but generally speaking, bigger sensors, or bigger pixels more specifically, allow us to get better quality out of our higher ISO settings. If you're really struggling with getting a lot of noise out of your images, perhaps you are using, for example, a smartphone that has a sensor that's really, really small, and because it has a very high megapixel count, the pixels also have to be very small, which results in a relatively noisy image at high ISOs. So one of the things that we've noticed is that ISO noise improvement has just been enormous, especially in recent years. The sensor is essentially a technology very similar to that of our computers, and over time, it's really, really improved. And nowadays, the noise that we see in digital cameras really greatly exceeds the noise capabilities of film. So in other words, with digital cameras, we can take images that are far less grainy, far cleaner than film. And this is maybe good or bad, depending on how you look at it. Sometimes you like having that additional texture for that, but you can, of course, add that later in software. So let's take these two into combination, in these two ideas, and combine them to realize how we can alter one to impact the other. So in the context of ISO and shutter speed, imagine that I am taking this photograph, which I did many years ago, back in 2007 in New Hampshire. I was on a dock at the edge of Lake Winnipesaukee, and there were some cool stars that I wanted, whose trails I wanted to capture. So I set my camera outside, changed the mode so that I could have several minutes worth of exposure time, and just waited outside in the cold for 15 minutes and got this picture. And so there's a variety of stars here. It's an okay photograph. But at the very center, I've highlighted one particular star, which I think I asked an astronomer friend, and they said it was Vega at the time. So one of the interesting things to notice is that you can, of course, see the Earth's rotation in the star trails. But notice that the radius of the circle seems to get smaller as you get to the upper right portion. That's because I was pointing, of course, the camera towards the north, and this was up here just off the slide just a little bit, was the North Star, around which the Earth's orbit was rotating. Okay, so anyway, we have this star that I want to point out, Vega. It has a specific length, and realize that if I wanted to make this star trail longer, the thing that I would need to do is to change the shutter speed. I would have to have the shutter open for a longer amount of time. But the amount of light in this scene is fixed. I can't actually change the shutter speed without changing something else, so that the amount of light that enters into my camera is actually continues to be correct, and I continue to get a properly exposed photograph. So I can, of course, change the sensitivity. And if you're able to look at this relatively small text below each of these images, you'll see the change that happened. Is that I changed the ISO by one stop, so changing it from ISO 800 to ISO 400, which then allowed me to increase the shutter speed approximately by a value of 2. And that is how we were able to get precisely this star trail that was twice as long. All right, so then let's talk about this third idea of aperture. Now, aperture, unlike shutter speed and ISO, doesn't have a very nice doubling or halving to represent a single stop change in exposure. And the reason for that is that aperture, or F number, is really a ratio of some things that are related to a lens. Now, this icon is actually from the now defunct Apple Aperture software, which is too bad. It was fantastic software. But one of the things that this icon has, which is representative of a lot of lenses that you have on cameras, is the data on the lower right of this lens. You notice that it says 50 millimeters, which is the focal length of the lens, and it also has this 1:1.4. I know it's upside down, but if you can read it as 1:1.4. And that is actually this aperture. This is actually the F number, the maximum possible aperture of this lens. And this is important because this tells us quite a few properties about this particular lens. The focal length tells us how zoomed in or how zoomed out it is. 50 millimeters on a typical camera is a very standard sort of field of view. It's not too zoomed out, it's not too zoomed in. It's perhaps somewhat equal to how it would look to our eye, but there's definitely some changes in the field of view. Let's take a look now at this aperture. The ratio here is precisely the ratio of the focal length divided by the aperture's effective diameter. So what does this actually mean? So let's keep in mind this division for just a minute. The F number from this previous slide was in fact this 1.4 value. The 1 just represents the fact that this is a ratio. And the focal length is this 50 millimeters. So this is important, and we'll be able to find out why in just a second. So here is an oversimplified view of a lens. It's a side view of a lens. On the very far right of this image, we have an imaginary sensor plane. Notice this symbol here. There's a vertical line with a circle. That represents a sensor plane. And if you happen to have a digital SLR or some sort of other advanced camera, take a look on the body of that camera. You might actually find this symbol, and that represents the plane through which your sensor actually exists somewhere within that camera. But anyway, the focal length is We can measure the focal length from the nodal point of the lens, which in this oversimplified thing just happens to be in the single lens element, all the way to the focal plane itself. And then there's an effective diameter of that lens. The diameter is the maximum aperture through which the photons are that enter and are focused onto the sensor. But imagine what might happen for just a minute if we had this amount of light that was actually able to enter through our lens, but we actually restricted this. So we had some sort of device that actually reduced the amount of light on the outside from coming into this lens. Very similar to the iris in our eyes. When you go outside, for example, and it's bright daylight, you might actually notice that your iris constricts to let in less light. Likewise, when you go inside into a very dark room, your iris expands to allow more light. It's precisely an analogous situation to what we have here. And so what this actually means is that the F number has some indication of precisely how much light this lens is actually able to accumulate through this diameter and the focal length. Because as we actually increase the focal length, the diameter would need to increase to allow the same amount of photons to enter into the lens and fall onto the sensor. So there's some math that we can do to actually figure out precisely what a stop difference is between the various F numbers. And I'll hopefully be able to post a handout next to the slides that will actually show you that math that go through this and takes all of this into account. But you can also sort of figure it out yourself through this ratio that we were just talking about. And imagine that the way that we're able to restrict light through this mechanism is to have different amounts of areas through which the light is able to flow. So if we have a circular lens that has an aperture that's this large, that means that photons are flowing through that area. But imagine how this might change if we actually restrict that area. So because we're actually talking about a difference in area rather than some sort of linear change such as shutter speed, this is actually what causes the very strange numbers that we see out of F numbers. So there's an easy way to remember the differences in one stop between all of the F numbers. First, remember two numbers, F1 and F1.4, and double each one to get a subsequent number. So for example, you would double F1, we get F2. So now the string of aperture values that we have are F1, F1.4, F2. Now we take that second number, 1.4, and double that. So now we have 2 and 2.8. And we can continue along in this fashion, 4, 5.6, 8, and so on and so forth. This breaks down after about 32 or something like that. But it's close enough approximation for our purposes. So just like shutter speed and ISO, the aperture does have an impact on our images. And one of the biggest impacts that it actually has, beyond the fact that it's allowing more or less light depending on whether we have constricted our aperture or increased its size, the biggest change perhaps that it has is the amount of background blur that you might actually have within your image. The larger the aperture, the more background blur you will actually have in your image. So you can reduce the size of the aperture, thereby letting in less light and get more of your scene in focus, or you can try to increase the size of the aperture by decreasing the F number, and you will get less of the scene in proper focus. And this can be an effective tool as well if you want to isolate your subject from the background, for example. Or perhaps you actually have a landscape shot and you want to do the opposite. You want to try to get as much of that as possible in focus. And so what you might actually do is then decrease the size of the aperture by increasing your F number and altering the other shutter values or the other exposure values as appropriate to actually capture as much of your scene in focus as you might like. So this is the big four. We've talked about the amount of available light, the shutter speed that's actually there, ISO, and aperture, and how the amount of available light is we're sort of at the mercy of the scene that we happen to be capturing, unless we happen to have an indoor setup or some other way that we can impact that amount of light, and how we can use the three values, shutter speed, ISO, and aperture, to vary the quality of or the amount of light that enters to our sensor and capture our exposure. And so there's this discussion of stops and how I mentioned earlier on how there's this distinction, there's about 20 stops difference perhaps between the brightest bright day and the darkest dark night without any moon shining or anything like that. And cameras tend to operate in a dynamic range, so the possible range of light that they can actually capture tends to be much lower, perhaps along the lines of about 10 stops, or maybe at a maximum 12 stops, and we're talking about some really high-end cameras here. You might recall from our discussion earlier of the Philae lander, that had some phenomenal technology. Well, the Rosetta camera had some phenomenal technology for the time period, 1998, and that actually has a possible 14 stops of dynamic range. But this really implies something about this, that if we have some object, such as the moon or a comet, that's illuminated full on by sunlight, with any atmosphere especially to reflect some of that light, then anything in the background is just going to be so completely dark that we're not going to be able to see it. So this is sort of the primary reason why a lot of these photographs have such harsh lighting, is that there's no atmosphere to reflect it and sort of fill in the gaps in the crevices of the moon, for example, or the crevices of the comet. But also, because the stars that are actually within the night sky are so dark relative to the ground that's being illuminated by the sun, that they fall away in exposure and we cannot actually see them whatsoever. So some terminology here, there's underexposure, overexposure. Sometimes there's both. Underexposure is when something's a little bit too dark. You actually need to increase the exposure to actually get all of the details. Underexposure, the hallmarks of it is everything just looks way too dark. The shadow areas have absolutely no detail. This one isn't horrendously underexposed, but it's pretty bad. Overexposure is the opposite. You have overexposed portions of your image and you've lost detail because it's simply too bright for your sensor. You might need to change your exposure values to compensate for that. And if you have both, well, you're just sort of out of luck. So one way to overcome these issues, because frequently you will come into a compromise between the capabilities of your camera and the amount that you can actually vary these three shutter or these three exposure values and the amount of light that exists in the scene, sort of one of the best power that you have, especially if you're taking photographs outside, is to just wait a little while for better light. Generally, midday light is really harsh. It casts very harsh shadows. There's less atmosphere to actually reflect and scatter some of the light, and so it just tends to be not a very good situation. But if you're able to wait even just a few hours, wait until dusk, or if you're able to do so, get up at dawn, and you'll be rewarded with wonderfully soft light that has a lot of color, warm colors and tone that results from the light passing through more of the atmosphere. Now, very quickly, there's this concept of metering, which is what the camera actually does on our behalf to alter each of these three shutter or all each of these three exposure values and try to capture an appropriate image. And generally what the camera does is it tries to take the entire scene and look at it in this sort of middle gray. It tries to figure out what is the middle tones, the middle brightness of the scene, and it will try to expose your photograph for it. And typically, there's some additional fanciness that goes into this. It will divide it into a variety of zones, and it will try to figure out in which zone you've actually focused and say, okay, that's probably a very important zone, and so it will apply some extra weighting or priority to that zone. All that stuff is fine, but this will still have the problem that even though you might have some images that are being exposed to this middle gray, the scene may not actually be appropriate for that. And so unless you're using the absolute most manual mode available on your camera, you're probably relying on your camera's meter to some degree to try to help you pick these exposure values. And this means that occasionally you need to do something called exposure compensation to notify the camera that the scene is actually a little bit different than its assumption. So in particular, if you have a scene where there's a lot of snow or a lot of white sand, as in the case of this image, or it has a lot of dark areas, it's a very shadowy, very dark alleyway or something like that, dark at night, and you actually need to notify the camera that it needs to not expose for the very middle, you can apply some exposure compensation to overcome this issue. So in this example, the original exposure that the camera wanted was on the left. Notice how it looks sort of dull gray. It's not precisely what you want. And I would suggest that this is actually one of the best things that you can do to improve your photography, is to pay more attention to the exposure compensation setting on your camera, because most likely, if you are taking a scene in the snow, which is especially relevant for those of us here in Cambridge, very soon it's going to start to snow, or if you're outside and it's dark at night, then you actually have to apply some exposure compensation. So You apply exposure compensation in stops, and what you do is you tell the camera to either increase or decrease the exposure compensation based on its assumption of middle gray. In this case, I know that because the scene was going to be brighter than the camera was expecting it, I needed to actually tell it to increase the exposure compensation. So by setting a positive one stop of exposure value, of exposure compensation, I told the camera that it's actually brighter than it was anticipating and would then take a properly exposed photograph. Likewise, we might have a scene that was too dark. For example, if you are trying to take an image of someone who's wearing a dark coat, for example, then it might actually confuse the camera into making everything a little bit too bright. You might need to dial in some negative exposure compensation to overcome this issue. Now, many cameras have a wide variety of metering modes. In fact, what you will find is that the simpler the camera, the cheaper the camera, the more modes it has. And this is just ridiculous, what they have gone through. I've seen cameras now with, of course, there's like a self-portrait mode, but they have like a party mode, candlelight mode, a sunset mode, fireworks mode, beach mode, snow mode. I saw one camera that had a beach mode and a beach 2 mode. So I have no idea what the difference between those two was. But it doesn't matter. You don't really need any of those modes because the vast majority of the time, they do nothing special to the camera, to the settings in the camera, other than altering these three exposure values. So if you just sort of think about what you might want out of that particular image, you could overcome those issues and use one of the simpler, one of the more raw exposure or metering modes so that you can actually take photos with a great deal more control. So for example, in a portrait, you might actually want to isolate your subject from the background, which would mean decreasing the f-number, having a very large aperture so you get very nice background blur from them or within that shot. And so that would be your priority. And that's precisely what the portrait modes in these cameras do, is it tries to make the aperture as large as possible and alters the other settings as a result. Okay, so let's go into a completely different direction and talk a little bit more about the digital aspect of digital cameras and just talk very quickly about sensors and some of the different technologies and some of the things that actually impact us as photographers. I alluded to dynamic range before, and we can think of sensors as being an array of buckets that capture light in the form of raindrops. So imagine we set out an array of buckets outside, and they're going to capture rain, and we can then measure the amount of rain in each of those buckets, and that is our image, so-called. And this, we can take this analogy quite far, and it's actually a relatively good analogy because it alludes to a number of things within the digital camera. Imagine a couple of scenarios. First of all, imagine what might happen if we allow rain or photons to actually fall into our bucket and not a lot actually falls in there. Now imagine that we have some sort of way of measuring this. If we have some measurement that's not accurate enough to measure the small amount of water that we've actually collected, then it's indistinguishable from noise. We're not actually going to be able to measure that as any sort of signal, and so we'll perhaps guess as to the value that is actually appropriate for that small amount of light. This alludes to this problem of sensors that do not collect enough photons, and it's just too dark, and so there's noise in these dark regions of the image. Likewise, if we allow too much to collect into this bucket, it might fill up and actually overflow. And so beyond that point, we have no way of measuring or knowing how much rain has precisely fallen within this bucket. We just know that it's beyond the maximum. And that's precisely what happens in these buckets as well, or in these pixels as well, is that once we've gotten to their maximum of voltage, then it's not actually possible to get any more detail out of that, and we would get an overexposure. We can actually take this analogy just a little bit further. If you imagine, again, this array of buckets that are sitting next to each other, this one of these buckets fills up with water, you can imagine it might spill over into neighboring buckets. And this concept is known as blooming within a digital camera. And we actually see this in a wide variety of circumstances where a very, very bright section of the scene that is extremely overexposed will actually bleed some of its data over to the neighboring pixels as well and cause those to become overexposed as well, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon. Now imagine that we're actually able to take a division between the maximum amount of volume that we're actually able to measure here, our full well capacity, our full bucket capacity, divided by the smallest possible signal. This would be our dynamic range. And one of the ways, there's a variety of ways that we can improve the dynamic range for a camera. And this, what this essentially says is the possible range, this range that we were alluding to before, that allows us to specify how much or how little light we can actually capture with our camera. So there's a variety of ways to improve this dynamic range, as you might imagine. One of them is to have a bigger bucket, actually allow us to capture a fuller signal. Another way to do this is to minimize the detectable signal, to actually decrease the amount of noise that we get out of the electronics of this particular sensor. And some of the advancements in recent years have in fact been to decrease the smallest detectable signal within this photo, within this sensor, and then we're able to improve our dynamic range and get improvements within our photographs. Now, one of the other really important things to realize with digital cameras is that they come in a variety of sensor sizes. And so there's a wide variety of sizes. One of the great things of modern digital cameras is that we're seeing larger and larger sensors in smaller and smaller cameras. But there's a wide variety of things that this actually impacts, not the least of which is the way that focal length will actually change the field of view depending on the size of the sensor. So imagine just for a minute, and as sort of a teaser for what you should look into after this seminar is actually over, imagine that we have a lens that, because it's circular, projects this circular image onto some location. And imagine we have a sensor that's relatively large and captures as much of this area as possible, in this case, our red sensor here. Now imagine we have a smaller sensor, this blue sensor, that captures the center portion of this image. If you blow both up to be approximately the same size, you'll notice that the blue sensor seems to be a crop. It seems to be this center portion, and it makes it look like you're using a larger focal length lens than you actually are. So for this reason, as we shrink the size of sensors, we also have to shrink the size and the focal length of our lenses in order to compensate for that change in the field of view. And as you might recall from our discussion about aperture just a few minutes ago, this means that we also have to change the diameter of our aperture to maintain the same F number. So we can go on and on into a wide variety of topics in sensor sizes and all of these things, but this is really just a teaser for some of the things that you might actually start looking into. When we start talking about this a little bit more, we start talking about 35 millimeter equivalency. We might have some sort of reference size of a digital sensor that we're able to compare other sensors to in order to discuss our focal lengths in a more meaningful way. And so I certainly suggest that you start doing your research in that area if you're interested in doing that. But for now, it seems like I've run out of time and we'll have to sign off. So I want to thank you all very much for viewing. I'll post the slides that we have here online and also that handout that allows you to understand a little bit more of the mathematics behind the wacky F numbers. And I do encourage you to take a look at that. And so thank you very much for watching, and I hope to see you soon. Oh, thank you. The illustrious audience enjoys it.